Shelley loved math and sciences. In high school, she excelled in all her classes, but having to take things like English and social studies and foreign languages was really a drag. Naturally, she was headed to college to study engineering. And at orientation, her college advisor sat down with her and told her that she could do an engineering major either in the College of Arts and Sciences or in the College of Engineering. And Shelley really wasn't sure what the difference was. Well, said the advisor, in the College of Arts and Sciences, you'll get a Bachelor of Arts degree in engineering, which means you'll do lots of math and science, but you'll also have to take core classes in literature and history and social sciences. But if you do the engineering degree in the College of Engineering, it'll be a Bachelor of Science degree, and you'll just do math and science. Shelley smiled as she imagined a program where you had to take only math and science. The requirements were a dream come true. So last week I suggested that the Ten Commandments should be read as a passionate lover drawing near to us to make our dreams come true. The commandments don't strike us that way. The law in general doesn't strike us that way. But that is only because we have believed so many lies about what will delight us. Right? Luckily for Shelley, she knew exactly what she wanted. But in real life, we're a lot more like the student who thinks he wants to study international relations. Right? He thought it would be all languages and culture, but when he got there, he discovered it was all political history and economics. He hated it. Right? He thought he knew what he wanted, but he was all wrong. Like him, we think we know what we want. And the Ten Commandments point us in a new direction and say, no, this is what you want. So we're going to read in Exodus chapter
20.
Yes. And incidentally, where's the other place that the Ten Commandments show up?
Deuteronomy 5.
Woohoo! Okay, so this is Exodus 20, verses 1 through 3. And God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. The word of God for the people of God. So that first part is really a prologue. Right, the bit about I am the Lord your God who brought you out of slavery, who brought you out of Egypt, is the basis, right, for the first commandment, and actually really for all the commandments. It says, I am Yahweh, right, and I wrote this week in the letter about kind of what that term is, where it comes from, and in the Old Testament, whenever you see Lord in capital letters, it actually stands for God's personal name, which is used throughout the Old Testament, used very frequently. So he says, I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. So the basis for all of the Ten Commandments is, first of all, who God is, right? He introduces himself. And then secondly, the basis is the concrete good that he has already done for them. Right? This cuts across any thought that the commandments, whether it's the Ten Commandments or anything else in the Bible, earns any response from God. Okay? Always, it is what God has done for us, and then the question of how we respond to what he has already done. And that's exactly what's happening here. Notice that it is not, I am Yahweh, God. Or, I am Yahweh, the God. Right? It is, I am Yahweh, your God. Now, God does not belong to us. We have no rights to demand any loyalty or anything else from him. He is God, we are not. He created us and may do with us as he pleases. He owes us nothing. And yet, before he asks for what he deserves, before he asks what is totally right, before he asks for our commitment to him, before he demands loyalty, he first does what is not called for and pledges his own loyalty, pledges himself, pledges his devotion, his unshakable commitment to us. Okay? So that's before any of the commandments. I am your God. I belong to you. The God who created us then says, I give myself to you. And making the commitment here even more personal, the you here, the you of I am your God, and actually all through the Ten Commandments, the you is singular over and over and over again. He's not giving himself to the nation as a whole. Rather, he is pledging loyalty, commitment, everlasting, unshakable kindness and devotion to each individual as such. The God who created the heavens and the earth looks you in the eye and says, I am yours. And this is evidenced in what he had done for them, right? He had delivered them out of the bondage that they could do nothing about. The scenes that we have in the beginning of Exodus, right, of them before Pharaoh and being oppressed and them trying to reason with Pharaoh and it just getting worse and worse and worse and them being utterly hopeless, right? You know the idea from psychology of learned helplessness, right? Where people don't even try to help themselves anymore because it never works. That was only 2 months ago when they're at Sinai receiving the commandments. Only 2 months ago, there was nothing they thought they would ever be able to do to change their situation. And here, 2 months later, they are in a radically different place. A place that they could never have imagined could even be possible. And there is only one reason for it, that God himself freely chose to give himself to them. God chose, for no reason other than his own desire, to be your God. The basis of the first commandment and all the others is that before we have done anything, he gives himself utterly to us to be a loyal, devoted God whose every thought and action is for our benefit. So then we come to the first commandment proper. You shall have no other gods before me. The phrase that here is translated to have is really, really common in Hebrew. It's used for all sorts of different ways that something can belong to someone. But one of them, one of the ways it's used, and it's a very noticeable one because it kind of stands out in Hebrew, is this is used of the marriage covenant. Okay? The language in the Old Testament is very frequently a husband has his wife, or a wife has her husband, right? It's actually the same phrase in Hebrew as what you also see in places of, I will be to you to be to you, right? Now, this could perhaps just be a coincidence of language, right? That this word that's used in all kinds of different ways, and one of them happens to be the marriage covenant. Except that this image of the marriage covenant is the image that the Bible uses again and again and again for the relationship between God and his people. Okay? In both the Old and New Testaments, from Genesis to Revelation and everywhere in between, the relationship between God and his people, or God and the individual believer, is most often, you would think, father, child, but it's not. That's maybe a close second, right? The number one most important, most common relationship that is used to give us an idea of the relationship God desires with us is actually the marriage relationship. Over and over again, the love that God has for his people and expects back from it, or not expects, desires back from his people, is pictured as the love of a husband and wife. It's very easy for people to think of the first commandment, you shall have no other gods besides or before me, as a tyrant king demanding an oath of loyalty while reserving his own right to do as he pleases. But the language actually suggests a lover who gives himself entirely to be devoted to love one alone and invites his beloved into the same place of exclusive devoted love. The phrase besides me, which is, you can see it, it's translated kind of 50-50, either besides me or before me, is used in a couple of different ways in Hebrew, which is one of the reasons that it can be translated either before me or besides me. But among other senses, it can mean before me, right? Meaning more important than me, priority among several, or besides me, except for me, other than me, which is exclusivity. In the first case, if we chose to prefer the translation, you shall have no other gods before me, then God would be acknowledging that there are a lot of demands in our lives, that we all have a lot of loyalties, right? That we belong to lots of different relationships, and that each of them have some claim on our allegiance, and that is all okay as long as Yahweh remains the most important among them, right? The other possibility, the one that would be behind the choice of you shall have no other gods besides me, is that Yahweh says that for his people there will be one and one alone, with no other room for any other allegiance. There will be no other loyalty, because the loyalty to Yahweh will be all-consuming. Now again, depending on our assumptions, this can sound unfair. It can sound demanding, if we think of it as the dry legal loyalty owed to a king. But it's not unfair and demanding. It's rather exciting and thrilling if we understand that it's the loyalty between two lovers who've spent 29 years together and cannot imagine that there would be anything better than this. Can you imagine loving someone that way, but only expecting that they would think of you as the best or the nicest among several boyfriends? Passion that is not exclusive is preference. Merely preference. The first commandment says, you have me as your God. To experience just how good I am, you have to let me have all of you. So, what threatens the exclusive relationship of passionate devotion? Other gods, right? In the ancient context that the commandments were spoken into, there were lots of gods. Every nation around Israel worshipped their own collection of gods, right? And I'm sure you're all familiar with that. Every nation around Israel had their own collection of gods, and because there are many gods, and because each of those gods has their own sphere of responsibility, you make sure that you give each his or her due so that none of them get upset with you and do something bad, right? At home, you have the gods of domestic tranquility. At work, where you're a coppersmith, you have the gods of metalworking. Right? And among your friends, you have the gods of drinking, right? But you still, in its agrarian culture, so even though you're a coppersmith, you still have your own fields to look after. So you have the gods of agriculture, and you have the gods of your livestock, and you have the gods of footwear that doesn't wear out, and all these things. And because all of those are concerns in your life, because all of us have lots of concerns, you got to keep all of those gods happy. The complexity of life means you owe them all a little. Now notice that all of those relationships sound a lot more like business relationships, contracts, I do my part to keep you happy, and you do your part to keep me happy. They're markedly different from the marriage relationship that God gives himself in. Now, of course, none of these gods actually existed the way that the true God, Yahweh, exists. But Israel was in constant danger of treating them as though they existed. And if they did treat these gods as having existence, then it would impact their devotion on the real God. Okay? Imagine someone who entertains a harmless fantasy about a famous singer or actor, right? A celebrity crush or something. They tell themselves it's harmless because there's no real relationship there. But you can be sure that imaginary relationship has real results on their real marriage. Without jealous protection, the priceless relationship they have with their lover, husband, God will suffer. Anything that is valuable requires protection. And incidentally, that's what jealousy is. There's a lot of unpleasant things that we call jealousy, okay, because we use the word very kind of broadly. But jealousy itself, especially in the Bible, jealousy itself is just the urge to protect the thing you value. When we hear that God is a jealous God, we shouldn't feel like somebody in an abusive relationship. We should say, thank goodness. God treasures us too much to allow us to loan ourselves out to other gods that will use us and dump us. If God only wanted certain obligations from his people, like the Sabbath observations and dietary restrictions and the sacrifices, right? If God wanted a business contract to ensure that he would get what he needs out of us, then Israel could have done all of that and still had a little bit of time and energy and maybe a spare lamb for other gods. But God doesn't want something from them, obedience to certain rules or sacrifices or anything else. He wants them themselves. He wants us, ourselves, in the exclusive relationship of passion. He is our God, and he wants us to be his people. This leaves no room for any other. So the jealous guarding of the exclusive relationship of passion is needed because without it, we unavoidably incline to whatever surrounds us. This is true of Israel in the ancient world, surrounded by other gods, and this is true of us today, surrounded by other points of view. Israel was surrounded by other gods that were treated as real by everyone. Surrounded by that, you can't help but over time start to think of them as real. And once any existence at all is allowed to them, then you can't help but give them just a little bit of their due. And in this way, the exclusive devotion of no other God slowly, very slowly, gives way to preference. No other God that can compare with Yahweh. Where Yahweh gets 90%, 99%, practically everything, and it's just a little bit of the scraps around the edges that he doesn't even really care about that just kind of get doled out to other things. Because, hey, there are a lot of demands in the real world. So we're no longer surrounded by other gods in the way that Israel was, but we most certainly do have things that compete for our loyalty. Other things, another way to think of it in terms of other than loyalty, is other things from which we expect we might gain some good. What is it out there that could bless us? Where do we owe loyalty and where do we expect good? Your job. Whether you think of that as how you earn money or whether you think of that as your career, right, with fulfillment and stuff. Money, a favorite activity, a lifestyle, right, a subculture, an identity or a self-image, a political cause or a party, an intellectual interest or a conceit, security, pleasure, comfort, leisure. Now, we need to recognize that these aren't necessarily bad things. And if we recognize that we're not making a list of bad things, we can even put in things like family. Okay? Now, we're not naming these things idols. We're just recognizing that they are things that we could devote ourselves to. And the reason that we're not just calling them idols, the problem with naming any of these things an idol, even money or pleasure, is that all of these things, more or less, are unavoidable in life. When you find an idol, you destroy it. You can't do that with your job or your family. You can't even do that with pleasure. We're not made for that. Okay? You need a job. You need a savings account. You even need things in your life that you enjoy doing. But the question is whether these things come to us as we devote ourselves to God alone, or whether these things get a little bit of our devotion alongside of God. And that's a hard thing to figure out. That's a thing where our hearts will mislead us. But the fact that it's hard to figure out doesn't mean that there isn't a difference there. I think Eric Liddell might be a good example. Everybody know who Eric Liddell was? It's the Chariots of Fire guy. Yeah. He knew perfectly well that athletics and competition could be a false god. And he was frequently warned by people around him that his love of running could swallow up his devotion to God. But as he made the choice to give himself and devote himself entirely to God, he found God telling him to run. In the same way, any of the things on our list can be a totally innocent and good part of our lives as we follow God. But any of them, even the best among them, can also become an idol the moment our devotion and expectation of blessing begins to leak. Because it's not all of a sudden, boom, reject God, choose something else. As the devotion and expectation of blessing begins to leak from God himself to the other thing, when God blesses me through this thing becomes God blesses, and this other thing is pretty good too, then we've moved from passion to preference. And here's the worst part. We don't start in the clear. Too often when we talk about idols and devotion to the Lord alone, we think of it as in, how do I keep myself devoted to God? That's a lie. We start on this slippery slope of idolatry. We start deep on the side of idolatry. We don't know what it is to be devoted to God alone. We've never been there. We start off with our hearts, our loyalty and devotion divided up between a host of modern gods, all offering us various delights and none of them delivering anything but anxiety. The question isn't, how do I protect myself from idolatry? The question is, can you imagine how blessed it would be to have your hearts freed of idols? Can you imagine how simple and satisfying to live with and for God alone. Can you imagine the peace and the joy? How wonderful to love Him who is the answer to all our longings and dreams. How do we get from here to there? Who will cleanse us? Who will give us that heart that is one direction? Who will give us that single eye that wants nothing but the exclusive all-in relationship with God, where because He has all of us, He's free to be all that He is? That's when God shows up at Sinai. That's when God, like a newlywed lover with fire in his eyes, draws near and says, "That's what I'm going to do. Brace yourself, because you are about to have no other God but me. And it's going to be the best thing that ever happened to you." It's not a tyrant's command. It's not a demand. It's the promise of a passionate lover. How do we then fulfill the first command? Well, in a way, we don't. Right? This kind of echoes back to Luther, and it's like the commands are just there to show us how badly we need help. It's not that we fulfill the first command. Jesus fulfills the first command, both in His devotion for the Father and in His ability to transform our hearts, to change us and to lead us into sharing His own devotion to the Father. Following Jesus, we grow into what the command envisions. And then our work, our participation, our choices, and our exercise of will is to long for that loyalty, to aspire to that devotion. And so when confronted with the first command, I think a proper response is to ask God to show us the things that divide our hearts. And this is going to be tricky because we're not going to want to listen. He's going to show us things that our hearts love. And it's going to feel like losing them. We ask Him, but all the same, we ask Him to show us the things that divide our loyalties and thus prevent us from enjoying the relationship that we were made for. And then as He shows us, we surrender. We yield to Him. We open up those fingers and we let Him do what He wants with that thing that we jealously guarded instead of jealously guarding Him. But that act, that surrender, it feels like being conquered by a tyrant, but it is not. It is being wooed by a lover to exclusive passion. Amen.